Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 14, Side 1. Magnifying his alarm, Monsieur Tyler had come back to the pilot seat and hummed a strange song. Mon Dieu! One did not sing when one faced certain death. Lunacy! Victoria gave them permission to land, and Johnny felt his way down through the rain clouds. His screens didn't clear up, but knowing the area, he could identify the scraps of image he sometimes glimpsed. It was useless to look through the screen. It looked like it had a fire hose being played on it. Johnny felt for the ground with his skids, more concerned about a bump affecting his passengers than about where he was. He did it very smoothly, and Pierre was again alarmed when Johnny turned off the motors. He thought they were still in the air. The rain was actually making it hard to talk in the cab of the plane. Johnny threw open the door, and there was Care standing there, water cascading off him in the plane lights. Even allowing for the deluge, Care was awfully glum-looking. He was usually very glad to see Johnny. The last time Johnny had been in Africa, he and Care had spent 3 nights working the Kariba rig. The planet Phobia had been very elusive. They had no coordinates for it beyond somewhere around the Cyclo Sun, and for a while it had seemed they would never discover it, and Care would eventually die from having no breathe gas. The planet was, however, located. It was doing a squashed ellipse. Phobia's perihelion, the point in its orbit where it was nearest its sun, was so much closer to its sun than its aphelion, the point in its orbit where it was furthest, and the distance to its sun from these two points was so vastly different, near and far, that anyone trying to live on Phobia would have perished, even a cyclo. Phobia went through 3 states. As it swung away from its sun, its atmosphere chilled and became liquid. As its distance increased, the liquid froze to solidity. As it again approached its sun, the sequence reversed and the atmosphere became gaseous again. But this long period of having a summer, and the Phobia year was about 83 of Earth's, permitted moss and other plants to grow, and these flourished for a time and then, as the atmosphere liquefied, remained in a state of suspended animation until summer came again. Although they had an awful time with camera triangulation to estimate its orbit, the end product had been beyond Care's wildest dreams. The planet was well into autumn, and it was no real trick to pump huge cable tanks full of liquid breathe gas. Not only that, but they had brought back about 50 tons of the material needed to make real goo food. Yes, Care had been acting like a cyclo gone to heaven, a most unlikely event, when Johnny and he had last met. And here he stood, glum in the rain.
"Hello, Johnny," he said woodenly.
"What's the matter with you?" said Johnny. "Lost your loaded dice?"
"Oh, it's not you, Johnny. I'm always glad to see you. It's that Maz. He was chief engineer here when the place was operating. One of the wounded ones. I got about 70 ex-prisoners from all over, and I'm trying to earn my pay by getting this tungsten mine going again."
He moved nearer, the rain cascading down his breathe gas mask, his tunic sodden with the hot rain that battered him.
"I'm no engineer," he suddenly wailed. "I was an operations officer. We ran out of ore body, and the next one is just beyond it someplace. That blank Maz and all those other blank cyclos just sit down there on their butts in gloom. Some blank fool showed them the pictures of cyclo blowing up, and they just won't do anything. I don't know any blank math, and I can't calculate the next ore deposits."
"That's two of us," thought Johnny. He was glad the girls didn't speak cyclo. The ex-underworld midget could really swear, but he almost never did unless he was terribly upset. "That's why I'm here," he said.
"Really?"
Care brightened up like a mind charge had gone off in him. "Has McKendrick arrived?" said Johnny.
"Control got a drone report on a plane from Scotland. That McKendrick? He'd be about 3 hours behind you."
3 hours? Johnny had wanted to get to work right away. Well, there was something else he had to do first anyway. Get some cyclo corpses. There's people in the back. Do me a favor and get them into the compound.
Right, said Kerr, cheered up.
He had a folded mine tarp on his arm he could use on the others as a rain shield. He sloshed toward the rear door, unfolding it. Pierre had been recovering, but now he was horrified to find that Johnny was rummaging around in a locker for high-altitude suits. Johnny threw one at him and began to pull on another one. Johnny heard the door slam in back and saw dim figures running toward the compound in the rain. He finished zipping up his suit and checked his fuel. Plenty. 20 seconds later, they were hurtling into the sky again. Pierre was still struggling into the unfamiliar high-altitude suit.
Mon Dieu! Life around Monsieur Tyler was hair-raising.
Johnny was unperturbed about it all. Up above the rain clouds, the screens were clean, and by seeing what stars were omitted, he could even eyeball the peaks. He left the plane lights on, heading for the glacial snows where they had left the cyclo corpses. He needed two, he thought. A workman and an executive. It did not help Pierre's frame of mind at all not to be told where they were going, nor why. Charging into the ink at such speeds appalled him. He did not even look at the view screens. His eyes were riveted through the now-streaked windscreen. Very shortly, Johnny was in the right location. He knew they had left a forklift up here. He would use that to guide in. He supposed that after all this time, the corpses would be pretty well covered with snow. But Pierre, not knowing what was being looked for, or where, or why, simply looked through the windscreen, his eyes dilated with something that was getting up close to terror. Suddenly, Pierre saw a whiteness. It had puffs blowing off it in the plane lights. With horror, he heard the engines wind down for a landing.
Don't! He screamed. Don't! Don't! You're landing on a cloud!
Johnny glanced up through the view screen. It did look like a cloud at that, seen from this angle. A high wind was blowing snow about. Ah, there was the forklift, up to its seat in snow and ice. The corpses would be lying, covered up, just beyond it. He had been flying by screens only. They were a long way from the nearest drop-off. He let the ship crunch down into the snow and shut off the motors. The wind was screaming up here, enough to make the plane tremble. Johnny settled his air mask on tighter. Get out and give me a hand. Pierre was in total confusion. He had clearly seen them land on a cloud, and he could not understand what was holding the ship up. He knew, from their earlier course, that they must be close to, if not on, the Earth's equator, and recent studies had told him that the equator was very hot, so snow was the furthest thing from his imagination. His small tribe had been under the domination of Jesuit priests, and they had controlled, by instilling a heavy fear of heaven and hell, mostly the latter. The reputation of Monsieur Tyler was itself a matter of growing superstition and awe. It surprised him less that they had landed on a cloud than it did to be told to get out. Pierre looked at the puffs of white in the ship's light. Yes, a cloud. He fingered the image of a crucified Christ that hung about his neck. He felt he was too young to be a martyr. But there was a solution. He snatched the jet backpack from the compartment behind the seat and hastily shrugged into it. Monsieur Tyler quite probably was able to walk on clouds, but that didn't include Madame Solon's son, Pierre. It took a lot of courage to open the door, but he did so. He closed his eyes tightly and sprang out, hand on the backpack firing trigger. It was about 8 feet down from a seat of such a plane to the ground, but Pierre had been nerved up to fall 12,000. When he hit the ground, despite snow, he almost broke his legs. Pierre fell backward in total confusion and lay propped on his elbows in the snow. He could not understand why he had not fallen through the cloud. Johnny, intent on his project, was oblivious of all this confusion. He had taken a mine crowbar from the plane's toolkit and was prospecting through the snow for the corpses. They certainly were covered up. The tip of the iron bar found one. He knelt and brushed away some snow, the particles flying away in the wind. He uncovered the tip of a breathe gas mask and then the ornament of a cap. Yep, an executive. He felt around under the monstrous shoulders to see where he had to insert the flat end of the crowbar to pry the monster loose from the adhesions of ice. One of these cyclos weighed about 1,000 pounds, more in all this snow and ice. Johnny inserted the crowbar deeper and heaved down on it. The monster was so stuck that the top end of the bar slipped and tore open his high-altitude jacket fastenings. He tried again, this time giving it all the strength he had. With a creaking, low-pitched sound, the monster moved upward. But the sound must have been close to that of clearing one's throat. The bank's singing button in his pocket gave out a ballad line with a baritone voice.
Ghost riders in the sky.
Pierre, already badly shaken, beheld a demon rising from out of the cloud. And not only that, it was singing in a sepulchral voice. It was a lot too much. With a low moan, he fainted dead away. 5. Johnny loosened the workman's corpse with the bar and then went to the forklift and knocked ice out of its cogs and ratchets. He was about to start it up when he noticed the absence of Pierre. He had expected him to open the loading doors of the plane, at least. He spotted the man lying in a shadow made by a balance motor. The snow was already blowing over him. A bit anxiously, he checked to see if he was injured, puzzled by the presence of the jet backpack, wondering why he was lying there unconscious. Well, this was no place for even first aid. Johnny got the forklift moving and scooped up Pierre. He ran the machine down the length of the ship to the doors and, standing on the seat, got them open. But the wind, coming from the tail of the plane, was trying to bang the door closed. Johnny jumped up to the fuselage flooring in hopes of finding something to block the door and stopped in his tracks. Patty. She was still in the plane. They must have overlooked her in their scramble to get through the rain. She made so little sound and motion these days, she easily went unnoticed. She must be freezing. Johnny opened an equipment locker and dragged out a blanket and threw it around her. She hardly even looked up. All he could find to block the door open was the stick from a map roller, and he tried to make it do by butting it against a floor equipment ring and pushing it against a hinge. He got down and operated the forklift to boost the inert body of Pierre into the plane. He had almost made it when a powerful gust of wind banged the door shut. Once more he climbed into the plane to try to make the stick prop the door, but this time the frail wood splintered. A soft voice sounded behind him.
I will hold it open for you.
Patty, gripping the blanket to her with one hand, put the other on the door and braced it open. This was the first time he had seen her volunteer anything for months. Johnny jumped down onto the forklift and raised Pierre up and dumped him on the floor plates. He got into the plane once more and began tugging the man over to the side out of the way, and was a bit amazed to see Patty pulling on the body to help. So, with Patty to hold the door open, Johnny was able to fork the two monstrous bodies out of the snow and dump them into the plane. Patty was watching him, and what he was doing, intently. Shortly, he parked the forklift, closed up the plane, and got into the cab out of the cutting wind. He phoned the compound to have a flatbed and forklift waiting, and then, checking to see if Patty was strapped in, shot the plane up into the sky. He had been prepared to feel his way down through the overcast with half-blind screens, and was very happy to see that the worst of the storm and all of its electrical interference had passed by. It was no longer raining at the compound, and they had every pole spotlight on. Quite a crowd had gathered around the waiting vehicles to see the plane come in. The last time Johnny had seen some of these ex-Marines and ex-spacemen had been through gun sights, and it was a trifle strange beholding Jambit Chows and Hawvins and such standing around, but they seemed inoffensive enough. 3 Chatavarian engineers in bright orange work suits that had Desperation Defense written on their chests were in the crowd, probably there doing preparatory surveys to convert this mine site protection over to the new system. A new plane was there with nobody around it, and Johnny realized that McKendrick must have arrived. He called Patty forward, and with her under one arm, jumped down from the plane. Kerr was sitting on a forklift. "The co-pilot is in there. He's breathing, but he must be injured or something," said Johnny. "Get him and the two cyclos down to the hospital." Johnny, still carrying Patty, rushed into the compound to find McKendrick. Kerr promptly got busy with the forklift and, with an expertise only Kerr could achieve with a machine, scooped all three bodies off the floor of the marine attack plane and swooshed them over to the flatbed. The driver, a newly trained Jambit Chow, looked on in wide-eyed shock as he saw two huge cyclo bodies plump down on the truck with a small human body dropping on top of them. The first impulse of the crowd seeing cyclos was to retreat, and fast. All the snow and ice had melted off them, and to all appearances they might be alive. The driver was about to get off the truck and put distance between himself and anything that had to do with cyclos that might suddenly come to life. Kerr withdrew the forks and realized he was in the middle of a commotion and was about to have no driver.
"No, no," he shouted. "They're dead."
Timidly, the Jambit Chow got back on the flatbed seat. Cautiously, the crowd crept forward to get a closer look. Eyes went questioningly to Kerr.
"Didn't you hear what Johnny told me?" said Kerr.
No, they hadn't. Too far away.
"Those cyclos," said Kerr, "have been hiding out in the jungle. They rushed out of cover and started to claw the co-pilot to bits. And it made Johnny so mad he charged them. He grabbed the throats of both of them at the same time and just plain strangled them to death."
Mouths were open and eyes were popped. The evidence was right there before them. After a moment, a Hauven ex-officer said,
"No wonder we lost this war."
"Yes," said Kerr. "When you get to know Johnny better, you'll realize that when he gets mad, he gets mad."
He signaled the flatbed to follow and drove off in the forklift. He just couldn't resist doing what he'd done. But the hardest part was to keep from guffawing in their faces. 6. Johnny, when he got into the compound, put Patty down and went looking for McKendrick. He found him in the hospital.
"Where's the epidemic?" demanded McKendrick. "I got your call in the middle of a medical lecture. I brought a whole medical team. And when I get here, I find you've taken off."
"This time," said Johnny, "we're going to do it."
"Oh," said McKendrick. "You mean the capsules. Johnny, I've tried every way I can think of, and there is no getting in those skulls. Too much bone. I thought I showed you."
The doctor went over to where he'd last left the huge cyclo skull. He knocked his knuckles on it.
"It's just plain, solid bone. The brain is clear down under the lower back plate. If I drill out enough bone to get to it, you'll just have a dead cyclo."
"Ah," said Johnny. "You used the word drill. I didn't."
He walked over to the skull and picked it up, all 50 pounds of it. McKendrick had wired on the joints, and Johnny opened the jaw. "Now, watch the ear bones." He got a better grip and held it up to the light, an action something like juggling a medicine ball. "Watch." He opened the jaw again. The hinge, not the place a cyclo heard through, but the place where the ear bone met the back jawline, opened to show a hole about a 32nd of an inch in diameter.
"You showed me this once," said Johnny, "and explained you couldn't get an instrument through it. But it leads right to the spots where the capsules are embedded in the brain."
McKendrick was skeptical.
"Johnny, I got a whole team in there cleaning the place up for a possible operation. I thought something serious had occurred. But as it's no emergency, why don't we just get some sleep?"
Johnny took the skull over to the table they had used before for dissection and put it down. "It may look like no emergency to you, but the truth is that we don't know how to make a cyclo motor, and we don't know how to work their math. If we don't know these things, we could come unstuck. We must have hundreds of planes right this minute that are inoperative. We need consumer products out in the planets, and the cyclo motors are tops. It's an emergency that'll do for now. But watch. Johnny took a thin insulated wire from his pocket and inserted it in the tiny skull hole. He took the other end of the wire and pushed it through the tiny hole on the other side.
"What are you doing?" demanded McKendrick.
"Now the question you must answer is, will these wires pushed in tear up any jaw or ear muscles?"
"Oh, they might hit some tissue, but the main muscles aren't there. That hole occurs because the jawbone, when extended to the extreme lower position, would have to leave a hole. Otherwise, there would have to be 2 additional bone plates, and Lord knows there's enough already. I don't think..."
Johnny reached for the kit he had hastily packed. He drew out a molecular plating gun. This thing pours a stream of molecules from a rod onto a surface. McKendrick was at sea.
"You can't get a gun like that in a head."
"The gun unit goes outside." He dug out an electrical terminal plate. "Where is one of those capsules we removed?" McKendrick got one of the 2 half circles of bronze. Johnny snipped off some lengths of insulated wire. He took the molecular plating gun and connected a length to the electrode that ordinarily fed current to the rod of spray metal. Then he laid the other end on the bit of bronze. He took a second piece of wire and laid it from the bronze to the electrical terminal plate. Then he connected the back of the terminal plate with a long wire to the current input terminal of the gun. He was simply going to substitute the bit of bronze for the gun's usual spray rod and then bypass the spraying component, but instead make the molecules flow on a wire to a receiving plate. And just to make sure electrolysis would occur, he was completing the circuit back to the gun. He pressed the trigger. The terminal plate began to be plated in bronze. A tiny hole appeared in the capsule taken from a cyclo head. No electrician, McKendrick said,
"It's disappearing."
"We're flowing the metal molecules up the wire to the plate. I think it's called electrolysis. We're just not letting the metal molecules spray. We're flowing them onto a plate." He adjusted the wires to the bit of bronze so that an inflow hit a different spot and the outflow occurred from a new place. McKendrick gawped.
"That piece of metal is disappearing."
"It's reappearing over on the terminal plate," said Johnny, "but that will be outside the head." He picked up a new bit of wire and with a small torch melted the end of it round. "If we take the sharp point off, can you wiggle this wire in through that hinge hole, around the various nerves, and touch the bronze bit in the skull? And then do the same thing from the other side?" This was something McKendrick knew about. The corded nerves of a cyclo brain were easy to push around. The cortex, or covering of the brain, could probably be pierced in a couple of tiny places without much damage.
"We'll see," said McKendrick, giving up all thought of waiting for morning.
The cyclo bodies were lying on 2 mine carts outside the door. Pierre seemed to have vanished. McKendrick called in 2 nurses and another doctor, and they wheeled the workman's cyclo into the dissection room. It was about 5 times as much body as they were used to handling, but with everyone helping, they got it on a table. "It's probably still frozen inside," said Johnny.
"No problem," said McKendrick. "You forgot? We've been through this before. A couple of times, I was all hopeful we could even operate."
He took a stack of microwave emanating pads and plopped them on either side of the head to thaw it out with a quick defreeze. The room seemed awfully populated. Mr. Tsung was giving Johnny a white coat and a pair of lensless glasses. Johnny wondered what they were for and put them in his pocket. He was about to order a repositioning of the body when the singing button started up. It sang, "Gone are the days when my heart was young and gay. Gone are the days..." The medical team was startled and a bit shocked. The scene was macabre enough without somebody singing a doleful dirge. Johnny pushed the button at Mr. Tsung. Get rid of this thing. Pulling other bits out of his kit, Johnny got to work making a more easily handled setup. Dr. McKendrick was getting the metal analyzer they used for an X-ray machine in place. He put the head of the corpse on it and tuned the dials so that he had a sharp, clean picture of the bronze capsule. He was testing the jaws of the corpse to see if they were flexible and, finding they were, propped them open with a metal expansion tool. The other doctor was mopping up water that had run off the cadaver's head and was getting the lower wave emanation plate wet. A nurse leaned over to Johnny and whispered,
"I don't think this little girl should be in here during all this."
Johnny turned, and there was Patty. She must have followed him in. She was looking with interest at the bleached skull. This was the first day in all these months he had seen Patty noticing her environment. He was not going to suppress her by telling her to get out. "Let her stay," he whispered to the nurse. The woman was a bit disapproving, but she did not push it. Johnny had his rig ready. McKendrick was looking at some sketches he had made of cyclobrain nerves. He laid the drawings down, took the offered wires, and got to work. Watching the viewplate and checking the sketches, he began to work a blunted wire end in. He finally, with a few minor detours, got it to the embedded bronze. Then he got the other wire through to the other side of the metal. Johnny verified they were ready and threw the switch. The exterior terminal plate began to turn bronze. McKendrick worked very delicately, feeding in electricity to one side of the plate and taking it from the other. It was, looking at the viewplate, sort of like cleaning up a blot. The bronze in the skull became less and less. McKendrick steered the wires around. After about half an hour, he could find no further shadows or traces of the bronze in the skull. He carefully withdrew the wires. "Now to see if we burned nerves," he said. The team went into immediate action. They broke out aprons and gloves and a set of instruments, including a spinning disc bone saw. The nurse leaned over to Johnny again and whispered,
"I do really think that little girl ought to go. This is too much for anyone that young. How old is she? 10?
Patty was sitting on a stool, overlooking the proceedings. She was very interested. Nothing could have made Johnny banish her. "Leave her alone," he whispered back. They removed the viewers and put down pans and cloths. And in a moment, the bone saw was whining and screeching into the skull. Shortly, green blood began to flow, and the team mopped it up. McKendrick had done this so often that it seemed only minutes before they were looking at the place where the bronze had been. McKendrick mopped up a bit more blood and got out a glass and inspected the nerves. "The tiniest amount of burn," he said. "I'll reduce the amperage," said Johnny. He got busy installing a rheostat in the circuit. The team was throwing the bits of the dead cyclo back together. They heaved him off the table and back onto the minecart and shoved him out in the hall. 2 minutes later, they had the former executive on the table. They repeated the molecular flow operation on the bronze and got rid of it. Johnny did a test on a silver capsule they already had from times past. McKendrick consulted his drawings again. The doctor pulled the wires back and fished them in again on the silver capsule in the cadaver's brain. It went along all right until they got to the fuse in it. It was so tiny and so quickly melted that it took quite some time to pick up all the bits. The wires, manipulated around, were more likely to touch each other than the scraps left. Eventually, that was gone too. Once more the gloves and saws, and presently the brain interior, mopped of green blood, was exposed. McKendrick went over it with the greatest attention. Then he stood up. McKendrick was looking at Johnny in awe. The lad had invented a new way to operate. McKendrick was thinking of the bullets and metal bits that could be removed with this, and without making huge incisions or holes. Electrolytic surgery. "It works on a corpse," said Johnny. He glanced at his watch. "It's near midnight now." Tomorrow, let's see if it works on a live one. 7. At 7 the following morning, McKendrick's team began to set up an entirely different room for operating.
"We don't know about cyclo diseases," he told Johnny, "and their cadavers might be very infective to them when decayed. They are built of viruses, and there may be a virus smaller than viruses. So change your clothes and get brand new wires and equipment."
Johnny did, and when he came back, having given Mr. Tsung the problem of digging up another white coat, and was laying out new wires, he was astonished to hear McKendrick tell his nurse to go get Chirk.
"She's almost dead," said McKendrick. "Cyclo females have been feeding her for months with a stomach tube. The brain structure is similar, and the hole in the jaw is bigger. She's already in a coma, and we won't have to give her much methane. That's the anesthetic that knocks them out."
"I better go get her," said Johnny.
He took a mine cart and an air mask and went down to the rooms, which were always circulated with breathe gas. Two cyclo females came over at once when he pushed the cart toward Chirk's bed. There she lay, eyes shut, unmoving. But she was thin, almost skeletal. Poor Chirk. The two hefty females had no trouble at all laying her on the mine cart. Johnny thought he might have been able to do it himself. Her bones almost rattled.
"Give me a breathe gas mask for her," said Johnny.
The two females looked at him blankly.
"Why?"
one said. "So she can breathe," said Johnny impatiently. The other female said,
"It won't do any good to try to torture her first. In her state, she won't feel it."
Johnny was trying to wrap his wits around this, and seeing his confusion, the first one explained,
"We have been waiting for someone to come down to kill her. They always do. We wondered and wondered while you waited months."
"That's the only treatment the Catrists ever permitted for Lapsin."
What were these words?
"Well, Catrist was the medical scientist cult that really ran Cyclo. Didn't he know that? And Lapsin was a common disease which child females sometimes got, and although it was rare for one of Chirk's age, she's 30, you know, to get it, it was undeniable that she had Lapsin. And naturally, sooner or later, she had to be killed."
"I'm not going to kill her," said Johnny, indignant. "I'm going to try to cure her." They didn't believe him. In the first place, it was against the law to cure Lapsin. It was also against the law for an unauthorized person to trifle with the mind. So it followed that he was lying to them just like a Catrist would. But it still wouldn't do any good to try to torture her before she was vaporized, as she wouldn't feel it, and he wouldn't enjoy it. Johnny had to get the breathe mask himself, put it on Chirk, and wheel her through the atmosphere lock. Behind him, the two females were telling each other,
"Torture, I told you so."
Even getting his toe back into the civilization named Cyclo had upset Johnny. But he soon had Chirk in the improvised operating room. Thin as she was, it still took three of them to get her on the table. McKendrick had drilled all this out long ago, and his team was quite efficient. The new doctor lifted the mask enough to slip an expander into the mouth. A nurse slipped a methane tube under the mask edge, and then stood with a stethoscope on Chirk's heart to detect beating changes. The heart evidently slowed down enough to suit her, and she nodded to McKendrick. The jaw holes were outside the mask edge, and McKendrick soon had the wires inserted through the tissue and into the brain. He positioned the head on the view screen very carefully. Johnny regulated the gun trigger for him. The nurse listened carefully to the heart and regulated the methane breathe gas mix. The capsule in her head got less and less. The metal on the plate terminal got more and more. 1 hour and 45 minutes later, McKendrick stood back, the extracted wires in his hands. A trickle of green on each side of the head was staunched by a nurse. The methane tube was taken away. The expander was removed from the mouth. The nurse turned up the breathe gas valve to maximum on the mask vial.
"We tried this on a workman a few months ago without operating," said McKendrick. "It will take her about 4 hours to come out of it, if she does."
Johnny was going to make sure nothing got in the road of her doing just that. He pushed the mine cart and its burden out of the room and back to the lower atmosphere lock. The two cyclo females were still inside and very surprised to see him. They gave him a hand, putting her back onto the bed. As Johnny was taking off her breathe gas mask, one of the females said,
"I suppose you brought her back here to order us to kill her."
That did it. Johnny kicked them both out. He got a chair and sat down outside the atmosphere lock. He was going to sit there all 4 hours and make very, very sure nobody else got any odd cyclo ideas. At the end of that time, he hoped Chirk would come too. But in any event, he was prepared to wait until she did. 8. Unfortunately for Johnny, it proved to be a rather well-traveled passageway, or people found excuses to travel it just so they could see him there. Chrissy found him.
"I'm awfully sorry we overlooked Patty. I thought you were coming right behind us and had her, and then when I saw she wasn't there, I ran out again, but you had taken off."
Patty was standing behind her, looking at Johnny.
"But that isn't what I must talk to you about," said Chrissy.
She produced from behind her an envelope and began to take things out of it. One glimpse of them told Johnny that Dries had been up to something else. They were the proof sheets, all marked specimen, not valid for exchange, of the new Galactic Bank money. There were 4 coins of different size and 4 bills of different size. The coins were different geometric shapes, well stamped. The paper and printing were excellent. Johnny couldn't imagine what was wrong with them.
"This 11th of a credit coin," said Chrissy, "is not too bad. It's green and you can't see it. The 3/11 coin, this blue one, is not too awful because you can't see it either. This red metal 5/11 coin is barely passing. The yellow 6/11 coin just won't do."
Hearing Chrissy expound upon money was novel. She had probably never used it in her whole life.
"But the smallest to the largest paper bank notes are what you should be concerned about. I told Dries I was very upset. This is the 1-credit note. And this here is what they call the 11-credit note, but it says 10.
"Cyclo number system," said Johnny. "It's based on 11, not 10. 10 means 1 unit of 11s plus 0 units of 1s, which equals 11. So an 11-credit note would be written in numbers as 10.
"I'll take your word for it," sighed Chrissy. "But that's not what I'm mad about. Here, look at these. This one is the 100-credit note. It says 100, but it's the same as 121 1-credit notes. Yes, yes, I know cyclo numbers."
She showed Johnny one more.
"And this one is the 1331-credit note."
Johnny had been looking at them. The coins had larger and larger stamps on them. The banknotes looked startlingly glossy with their shimmer paper.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I don't see anything wrong with them."
"It's the face," said Chrissy. "Look. On the coins, they have your face in profile, and you can't see it on the smaller ones, but you can on the yellow one because it's big enough. The nose. Your nose isn't turned up at the end."
Johnny took the coins. Yes, it sure was a turned-up nose.
"And these bills. I don't care," said Chrissy, "if it is hard to reproduce accurately, like Dries says. They made your skin grayish. The eyes have too big a lid. And, Johnny, your ears aren't like that. These look more like gills."
Johnny took the bills. Sure enough, they had changed the portraits. Then he barked a laugh. He still looked enough like himself for no real dispute to rise. But they had shifted it over so he slightly resembled a Salachi. Great. Less chance of being pointed at in the hills. But Johnny had learned a lot about diplomacy. "I'm sorry you don't like them, Chrissy."
Oh, it's not that. It just doesn't look like you.
I'm afraid it would cost an awful lot and make a lot of trouble to change them now, said Johnny. Maybe the next issue. That seemed to mollify her, and she put them back in the envelope and walked off, noting from the way he seemed to have nailed himself down that he might have to be fed lunch there. Patty stayed behind and sat down on the floor. She still seemed very thoughtful, but she was not as dull as she had been. Care came up the ramp, followed by about 30 assorted ex-Marines, Jambit Chows, Drawkins, and a couple of Hockners. Care went on by with a friendly hello. But when the others got abreast of Johnny, they suddenly realized who was sitting there. They recoiled so hard against the far side of the passage that they bounced. They instantly raced up to be in front of Care. Johnny had not missed it. He called out, "Care?" The midget Cyclo walked back to him, leaving his group standing in the passageway. "Care," said Johnny, "what have you been telling those ex-soldiers?"
"Nothing," said Care,
amber eyes glowing with innocence back of the faceplate.
"They're just kind of hard to handle sometimes."
"Well," said Johnny, "whatever that nothing was, you straighten it out."
"Of course," said Care.
He turned and yelled up at the group,
"It's all right. He isn't mad at you right now."
They all seemed so relieved. Johnny gave Care a very suspicious eye. The midget yelled at the Hockner ex-officer to take them to the garage and get busy washing down machines, and then turned back to Johnny.
"You had me scared there for a moment," he said. "I thought you'd really caught up with me."
"Something else?" said Johnny.
"Ha ha. Well, it wasn't true that he had been the only one here when everybody, including the Mountains of the Moon people, had taken off for Edinburgh to help. They'd left their old ones and their kids.
And he'd gotten bored just sitting with a blast rifle in his lap up the corridor there, and he'd found one of the old ones spoke a funny kind of Dutch.
That's an Earth language, or was.
And Care had found a vocoder in the Chinko bin that had had Dutch in it, so he'd amused himself by telling the old one's stories to relay to the kids that were always hanging around. The children had been pretty shy at first, thinking he was a monster and all, so he'd told them that he was really human, that he had a human mother and father. But his mother had been scared by a cyclo, and so when he was born, he looked this way. But he'd be honest with Johnny and level with him because he was a boyhood friend, and Care confessed he was only half-human.
"Not to change the subject," said Care, doing it, "but I heard you say something about handling a problem. I can't wash vehicles forever. When are you going to get busy and nail Maz so I can get this mine going again?"
"I'm working on it right now," said Johnny. He looked at his watch. Another hour and a half to go. And then he'd have an idea whether it would fully work or not. 9. Perhaps because she had been so weak, it was 5 hours and Shirk had not stirred. Johnny had moved his chair in to the foot of the bed and sat there with an air mask on. Patty had tried to come in, but Johnny had blocked her until he could find another mask. Breathe gas could send one into convulsions. So Patty sat now with her back to the wall, cross-legged on the floor, watching Chirk. The cyclo's breathing seemed to be less shallow, or was he just being hopeful? No, he wasn't. Chirk had moved a paw. Very slight, but she had moved it. After a long time, Chirk let out a fluttering sigh. She opened her eyes and looked dully about her. She finally focused on Johnny. She simply looked at him for quite a while. Then, abruptly, Chirk hitched herself up on her elbows and said with some authority,
"Johnny, did you send that library form in like I told you? The Home Office is going to be pretty cross if it finds you've got an incomplete set of books down here."
Johnny heaved a sigh of relief. Part of it was for the practical value of this. Part of it was for Chirk herself. He was about to answer when she caught sight of her arms. Puzzled, she said,
"What am I doing so thin?"
She hitched herself up a little higher.
"Why am I so weak?"
You'll feel stronger when you've had something solid to eat. We have some very good goo food now, and even some chew roots. Her interest was immediate and then faded. Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 14, Side 2. Her interest was immediate and then faded.
I've been here for some time, haven't I, Johnny?
A while, said Johnny. She thought about it. Then she stiffened.
I've had lapsin. It's incurable.
She let out a wail. It's cured, said Johnny. She thought about it. Then another upset took her.
But why didn't they vaporize me? The catrists.
I think you'll get well, said Johnny. In fact, I think you'll be healthier than before. She thought she understood.
You're sitting there so they won't come in and vaporize me. Johnny, that's brave, and I should thank you. But you can't stop the catrists. They're the law. They're beyond the law. They can do anything they please, even to the Emperor. Johnny, you better get out of here before they come.
Johnny looked at her for a while. What a world of terror and cruelty these cyclos had lived in. He said, I'm sitting here to tell you the news, Chirk. I fired the catrists. Well, it was true, wasn't it? Even if he didn't really know what a catrist was, if they'd been on Cyclo, they were fired. Radioactively. Chirk sat up higher, shedding the dullness.
Oh, Johnny, that was awfully nice of you.
She swung her legs to get off the bed.
Where are my clothes? I better get to work or I'll have another black mark on my record.
She tried to stand. I'd take it easy, said Johnny. Then an inspiration. It's your day off. She sank down on the bed, shaking with weakness and evidently dizzy.
Oh, that's lucky. Will it be all right if I come in tomorrow?
Johnny assured her that it was. He went out and found the two females, and perhaps because of his reassociation with Care, he told them he had an order that exempted Chirk from being vaporized, and that if they harmed her, he'd dock their pay and put black marks all over their records, and they better go get her some goo food and chew root and help her take a bath. They did not misunderstand him. Whatever else he said, he had a palm resting on his belt blast gun. They understood that. Chapter 32. The Last Chapter. 1. With all the weight hanging on the outcome of this project, Johnny was in no frame of mind to be told that it would be 3 days before they could be sure they had succeeded with Chirk. McKendrick said there were dangers of infection, of relapse. He had to observe the reactions before he could proceed. In vain, Johnny told him that unless they solved cyclomath, he might find himself back in a conference room with very angry emissaries whose economies had remained stagnant, that he might be pushed into a new demonstration of force. McKendrick said it wouldn't help to rush it. And Chirk did not instantly rebound. On the second day, she was still in bed, too weak and dizzy to get up. It made Johnny wonder whether the removal would disturb their sense of balance, even their ability to think. Other things occurred. Pierre Solon had vanished, and it took Johnny hours to find that he had been seen boarding a plane that had come through, sky-hiking his way back to Europe. Patty seemed to have undergone a change. Johnny was sitting in the old library, impatiently thumbing through books, when he became aware of Patty. She obviously had something to say. He sat quietly, giving her his attention.
Johnny, please tell me the truth. Did Biddy live very long?
It startled Johnny, hurled him back to that fatal day. A wave of grief choked him. He could only nod faintly.
Then he could have been saved,
said Patty, not accusing, just stating a fact. Johnny looked at her. He couldn't talk. Dear God, no. The boy was blasted half in two. His spine was shattered. Nothing could have saved Biddy. Nothing. But he couldn't say that to her.
Johnny,
If I had known how to be a doctor, and if I had been there, he wouldn't have died.
She said it as fact, conviction. He waited. He couldn't talk.
When the doctors leave here, I want to go with them, said Patty. I will be very good. I will not bother them. I will go to a school and study real hard, and I will learn everything I have to know to be a doctor. Will you help me, Johnny?
He couldn't talk. He put his arms around her. After a while, he was able to say, Of course I will, Patty. You can stay with Aunt Ellen. I will speak to McKendrick. I will see you have all the money you need. She stepped back, her eyes bright with determination. With dignity, she said,
Thank you,
and went away. After a little, he felt a sense of relief for her. He had thought she would never recover, but she had. There was a direction for her to go, and she had found a path to travel on, a path that led out of despair and back to the world of the living. On the following day, he had been down in the electrical shop, organizing equipment and needing a reference on molecular gun current values. He raced up to the library to get it, and there was Chirk. She was sitting at a desk, surrounded with books.
Johnny, she said a little severely, you let this place get in an awful mess. You must learn to put things back when you pull them off the shelves.
He looked at her. Inside her breathe mask, her jaws were chomping away on chew root. Her amber eyes seemed totally clear. She had already put on a bit of weight.
The company is very strict about orderly libraries, she said. You must remember that.
She went back to getting volumes in order. Her coordination seemed very exact as she stacked things with sure paw motions. The resulting piles were very even. Not even a tremble. He was about to go tearing off to spread the news.
Johnny, said Chirk pensively, I've been thinking about mathematics. If you still need me to help you, I'll try to learn to add and subtract and all that sort of thing. But Johnny,
and she fixed him with a very questioning stare,
truthfully, why should any intelligent person want to do mathematics? I mean, what use are they, Johnny?
3 minutes later, an excited Johnny was telling McKendrick they could roll. 2. They had taken time and worked it all out. There was always a risk in handling cyclos, even in just being around them. One rake of a paw's claws could tear one's face off. McKendrick had actually started on Chirk because there was less danger of it. The worker he had tested earlier had been a risk. The cyclo had surged up when half anesthetized, and had it not been for straps, somebody would have gotten hurt. So putting a cyclo under and operating when that cyclo was apprehensive, believing perhaps he was about to be killed, was a thing to be avoided. The younger doctor had been trained, as many general practitioners were, in rudimentary dentistry. He examined a couple of skulls, studying the fangs and back teeth. They were caked with a coating from goo food, which seemed to turn black in time. There were a couple of cavities evident. Johnny got him some silver and mercury so the doctor could make an amalgam for filling. He also fashioned a breathe mask for them which used the nose bones and made some plugs which could block the mouth air passages and force the cyclo to breathe only through the nose. He also found some small drills. The plan was to tell all the cyclos that it was a new regulation that they have their teeth repaired and polished. They said it could be painful, so it was being done under an anesthetic. The cyclos, as a group, when being briefed, were a little dubious, mostly because the company had never had any concern for employee health. But new place, new ways. The team set it up as an assembly line. The cyclo would be brought in, put under, and have the capsule or capsules removed, and then would be pushed down to another table where the younger doctor, taking advantage of the anesthesia, would fix and polish up the fangs and back teeth. In this way, after the first one, each cyclo entering would see another cyclo lying there, unconscious, getting his teeth fixed on another table. The metal analyzer on the first table was explained as necessary to find cavities. They rolled up their sleeves and began to roll. The assembly line went off without a hitch. A cyclo would come in and get the metal removed from his brain, be shunted over to get his teeth fixed, and then be wheeled back on a mine cart to the cyclo area of the compound to recover. It took 144 working hours, 12 days, to get the whole lot through. The early ones were all up and about before the last one was finished. They had had a lot of cavities, even some minor extractions. But their gleaming fangs, my, were they impressed. Walking about, whenever they passed a reflective surface, they could be seen holding their breath, lifting their breathe masks, and inspecting anew their beautiful new smiles. A cyclo admiring beauty was a major change in itself. They did not become more polite, but they became more pleasant and agreeable. Care couldn't stand the others getting all this without himself getting into the scene. He didn't even know he didn't have any capsules, but he did know his fangs weren't shiny bright. So they had to pull him in, put him under, and polish his teeth. And that finished the lot. The medical team took the cricks out of their backs and began to pack up.
"It's all over to you now, Johnny," said McKendrick. "Be careful, as we have no guarantee they won't retain some residual behavior pattern based on tradition and education. I hope you finally solve their math."
And the team went back to Aberdeen. Johnny was on his own. 3. Chirk collected the company personnel records for him, and Johnny went through them one by one as they were handed to him. Just now, she had a big, thick, tattered folder that was all water-stained and mildewed. Johnny took it. It was the record of one named Soth, an assistant mine manager who had served in the compound near Denver. Johnny had never seen him there. He must have kept to his room or his office. Some of the reason was visible on the record. Soth was 180 years old. A cyclo lifespan was around 190, and it meant that Soth could not have been feeling all that spry. But there was more in the record. Since the age of 50, Soth had never returned to cyclo. He had been shipped all over the universes, serving 2 years here, 4 years there. But never a return to cyclo. He had even been cross-fired on rigs every time, a thing that was very unusual, as almost all cargoes went via cyclo, and Johnny had thought that all personnel did. In fact, this insistence on using cyclo as a transfer point was the main bottleneck on the expansion of the cyclos. The transshipment platform there could only handle so much cargo and firings in a day. Johnny had already started doubling up platforms in places, one to receive and one to fire. Johnny studied the record. Soth, after graduating from mine school, had been an under-professor of ore theory. It all seemed quite usual right up to the age of 50, when abruptly he had been assigned as an assistant mine manager to a very remote planet. And for the next 130 years, he had been shifted continually, always retaining the same rank. It was an oddity. Johnny went through the reams of records on him, and finally found one of the same date as his original transfer from cyclo. It said, "Unsuitable for teaching profession. Fla, Chief Catrist, Gru Clinic, cyclo." That little slip of paper had condemned a being to obvious exile for 130 years. No other black marks evident. Always seemed to have done his work, nothing negative otherwise. Instead of going straight to Soth, Johnny instead made a test with Maz. This cyclo, at whom Care was mad, was one of the biggest Johnny had ever seen. He had been the local planning engineer. Remembering the Champco brothers, Johnny loaded up a hand blast gun just in case, positioned himself in a room where he had lots of space to back up, and had Maz brought in. Maz's teeth were gleaming behind his faceplate. He sat down easily enough. He was a bit surly.
"I hear that Care clown has been saying I won't work," began Maz with no preliminary. Contract or no contract, if you think you can put a midget operations officer over the head of a planning engineer, you think trouble.
He just wants to get the tungsten mine going, said Johnny.
What's the point? You can't ship it to Cyclo. You finished that.
Johnny thought he might as well dive in now rather than drag it out. If you'll give me the mathematics to compute the location of the next ore body, I'll work it out. Maz scowled. Johnny prepared to draw.
Somehow, said Maz, and his scowl deepened. I don't think I'm supposed to talk mathematics with an alien.
He thought it over. He lifted a back strap of his breathe mask and scratched under it. A considerable time passed.
I can't think where I got that idea. Mind school? Yes, mind school. Say, this is funny. I got a picture of somebody holding a whirling spiral in front of me.
He yawned. He thought a while.
Hey, he said explosively. That's the catrist in charge of our group. You know, I haven't thought of him for years. Funny old blank. He used to spend hours with the youngest males. When he wasn't down in the sex shops of the old town. Yeah, it was him. What were we talking about?
Showing me how to do mathematics, said Johnny. Maz shrugged.
Why bother? Take a lot less time for me to do the calculations myself. What's he going to do with the ore?
Cross-fire it to other planets, said Johnny.
That's kind of illegal. How much bonus? For me, I mean.
The usual, said Johnny.
Tell you what. You tell that Care he ain't no boss of mine and mind his manners, and you double my planning bonus per ton, and I'll calculate the ore body.
He laughed.
There's a lot more tungsten there than I ever told the company. Is it a deal?
Johnny said that it was, and Maz left. It was an inconclusive test, but he hadn't been attacked. He waited for 2 days for Maz to commit suicide, but he didn't. He just went out and started giving Care a hard time, but in the process he broke out his analyzers and instruments and stakes, and shortly was shooting glow stripes into the earth to give workers lines along which to dig. Johnny used the time otherwise as well. He went down to Salisbury, and with Thor to back off the elephants and black mambas, dug into the man books trying to find anything about whirling spirals being held in front of people's faces. He found one reference to it in a booklet named Hypnotism for the Millions. Seemed kind of silly. He made one, and with Thor holding a small deer, spun it in front of its face, and all the deer did was stare at it. Thor said to try it on him, and he did, but Thor just went into gales of laughter. According to the book, you put people to sleep and told them things, and then the people would do them afterward without knowing it was an order. Johnny guessed Cyclos must be different if it worked on them. Anyway, he had an idea of what the Catrist had been attempting with Maz. There had been some effect, but not enough without the capsule. What a weird world those Cyclos had lived in. Imagine putting a whole population under a mental cloud. But the idea wasn't solely Cyclos, for there it had been among the spider webs of the old man library, and it had been a man book which had led him onto the capsules. How could any being consider itself so right as to think it should make all other beings into robots to do its bidding? He thought of Lars. Had Hitler been doing things like that? As Maz, according to a call to Victoria, was still going strong, Johnny went back to tackle Soth. If anyone knew math, he should. Johnny was determined to get motors into production, and after all this time of getting trouble from cyclomathematics, he was feeling quite willful about it. This had to be revealed. There were no two ways about it. Turl and his condemned equations that wouldn't balance, that never made any sense. Why, if something happened with a console, he'd never know what was wrong with the circuit. He couldn't figure one out. Not with cyclomath. Suddenly, he remembered the Voraz letter. Hundreds of thousands of inventions and the formulas all in cyclomath. To really get the crashed arms companies converted over to consumer products, those hundreds of thousands of inventions, even though accumulated for millennia and probably stolen by the cyclos from now defunct races, could very well spell the difference between booming prosperity across the galaxies and having to face a new conference of emissaries howling for his blood. Nobody would be able to figure them out unless he could pry the secret of cyclomath out of these ex-company employees. Mr. Tsung had been right. It could become a diplomatic matter. It could even become war. 4. Soth, Johnny found, did not live in the dormitories. Apparently he coughed at night and kept other cyclos awake, and they had insisted he be berthed in a small former storage room that was hooked into the breathe gas circulating system. And that was where Johnny found him. The room wasn't too bad. The old cyclo had cut down the original storage shelves and fabricated some bookcases and tables from them. The cases were utterly jammed with books, and the tables covered with a litter of paper. Soth was sitting on a high stool as Johnny entered. His fur was splotchy with blue hairs, sign of an aged cyclo. The amber eyes were a bit blurry with white matter at the corners. He was dressed in a wraparound robe, and he had a small cap on his head. He peered nearsightedly at Johnny, evidently seeking to see who it was. Then he remarked the belt gun.
"So you have come to ship me on," said Soth. "I was wondering when someone would notice."
"You seem to have a lot of books here," said Johnny, seeking to change the subject.
"I was fortunate," said Soth. "When that first attack came on the compound, I was in my office and I heard the fire gongs going. I knew there'd be a lot of water, so I ran down to my room and put everything I had into waterproof ore bags. Then, when we were to leave for here, I asked a nice young human if I could go get them and bring them, and he permitted it."
Johnny was looking at the titles. He couldn't read most of them. They were in scripts he had never seen before.
"They usually let me keep my books," said Soth. "In cross-firing, they don't much care what weight or cubic space there is, for there's nothing else going. Will you let me keep them when you cross-fire me this time?"
Johnny was afraid for a moment that this old cyclo must be in his dotage. Then he realized they wouldn't really know that there were no other cyclos alive. They might think there were other captives elsewhere. "I'm not here to crossfire you. We're sure there are no cyclos on other planets now." Soth digested this. Then he let out a little snort.
"Funny way to end 130 years of exile. But it's not ended. I'm still exiled even if I stay here."
Johnny had him talking. He had better keep him talking. "How did it start?" Soth shrugged.
"The way it always starts, being impolite to a catrist. Isn't it in my record?"
As Johnny shook his head, Soth went on.
"You might as well know. Lately, I have had this strange feeling that I should be more honest, and I do appreciate your fixing my fangs for me. Two were quite painful. Anyway, we had this young cyclo in school, and he got confused about his lessons and wanted a better explanation."
"About mathematics?" said Johnny. Soth looked at him for quite a while.
"Why do you ask that?" he said finally.
A sort of cloud had passed over him and gone away. Then, as Johnny didn't reply, he went on.
"Well, yes, it was about mathematics in a way, I suppose. It was how you calculate ore bodies in semi-core mining."
He sighed.
"Somebody must have reported him because the catrist of that school wing came in and started shouting at him, and then started shouting at the whole class. It was very disruptive. There's no excuse for what I did, really, but for years I used to think it was because my mother was a member of an underground church group.
They believed that sentient creatures had souls, and they felt very strongly about it. It wasn't that she was caught or anything, but some of it must have rubbed off on me to make me do what I did. This catrist was standing there screaming at the class that they were all animals, and they better remember they were animals. And he was making so much noise, I must have gotten confused. I did want him to quiet down because I had a class to teach, and it just slipped out.
He sat for a long time.
It's sort of painful to talk about this. I never do. If word of this got back to the...
Then he let out a slight gasp.
I just realized they're all dead. It's all right if I talk about it.
Then he looked closely at Johnny.
It is all right, isn't it?
Sure, said Johnny. I don't even know what a catrist is.
You know, said Soth, I've come to believe I don't either, really. But because of what it did to my life, I pieced a lot of it together. There's lots of books on lots of planets. 250,000 years ago, Cyclos were really a different people. They didn't even have the name Cyclo. I think sometime or other, they must have gotten frightened of somebody invading them or something. As near as I could piece together, there was this group of carnival performers. You know, mountebanks, frauds. They were the original Cyclos. They used to hypnotize people on the stage and make them do funny things to get the audience to laugh at them. Just trash. Actually, just criminals. When this panic came on, they went to the Emperor and told him something or other, because the next thing anyone knew, they were in charge of the schools and medical centers. The race before that had been called after the current Emperor, according to books on other planets. Well, right at that time, they began to be called Cyclos. That was the name of these carnival performers. So instead of being called after the ruler, the race was now called after the Cyclos. It means brain, according to some old dictionaries. Another form of the word also means property of. Everyone became the property of the Cyclos. Anyway, members of this mob of cutthroats began to call themselves Catrist. That means mental doctor. So the people became Cyclos, or brains, and the Catrist, or mental doctor, was the real hidden government. They taught all the children. They inspected every citizen. They suppressed religion. They told people how to think. Oh, I was stupid. There's no excuse for what I did.
He fell silent.
But this Catrist was raising so much row. I should not blame my mother. I should never have blamed her.
He paused again and drew a long breath.
I just blurted out. I said, they are not animals.
He shuddered and after a while said,
so that began my exile. Now you know.
What Johnny now knew was that that mob of frauds was stark staring insane.
Well, said Soth, coming out of his despondency, if that isn't why you're here, why are you? An old ruin like me has nothing to offer.
Johnny decided to dive in. You obviously know mathematics. Suspicion clouded Soth's already roomy gaze.
How did you know my hobby was mathematics? It isn't in my record. I paid a female clerk 500 credits once to see it, and I know.
The mystery of it threw him. Then he solved it.
Ah!
He swept his paw down the bookshelves.
My books.
Then he clouded over again.
But they're mostly outer language books, and very few people can read them. A lot of the races are even dead. Come, he pleaded, tell me why you're here.
I want you to teach me about cyclomathematics, said Johnny. There was a sudden tension in Soth. He seemed to become confused. Then it seemed to clear away.
Nobody has asked me to teach them anything for 130 years.
You're an alien race. But what does it matter? There are hardly any cyclos left. What do you want to know?
The tension slid out of Johnny. He'd made it. 5.
In the first place, said Soth, after he had made himself more comfortable and taken a small bite of the kerbango Johnny had produced, there are an awful lot of different kinds of mathematics, different races, you know. I sort of kept my interest in life by collecting them. There have been existing systems for lots of different whole numbers. There's the binary system, like the Chatoverians use. It has only two numerals in it, 1 and 0. That's so they can use them in computers, in which the electric current pulse, or the direction of magnetization of an element, has 1 of 2 values. 1 value corresponds to the numeral 0, the other to numeral 1. Any number in any system can be translated to the binary system using only 0 and 1. Unwieldy for beings, but understandable for the computers. Then there's a system based on the integer 3, an entirely different one based on 4, another on 5, another on 6, another on 7, still another on 8, yet another on 9, and so on. There's even been one on 20 and one on 60. For paper computation, the best system is called the decimal system, based on 10.
Johnny knew about this from man books.
Cyclomathematics are based on 11. Some people call this the undinary system. It's difficult, so I won't try to teach you that.
Oh, I would love to know about the undinary system, said Johnny. His use of the words love to know gave him a twinge of conscience. He hated this confused mess.
I can teach you the decimal system much more easily, said Soth. Whenever they discover it on some planet, they engrave the discoverer's name among the heroes.
He saw Johnny wouldn't buy it and sighed.
All right, he said.
He got a sheet of somewhat crumpled paper.
I will write down the undinary numerals for you.
Johnny said he already knew the cyclonumerals, but Soth shook his head.
No, no, said Soth. I doubt very much if you do. To really understand a symbol, you have to know what it came from. Now, all numerals as symbols were originally either the first letter of the word that spelled them, or a number of dots or lines. Or they were pictographs that then became stylized until they were only a part of the original picture or a shorthand version of it. Now, cyclonumerals were originally pictographs, and then, as time went on, they were written in a more and more simplified form, until they are now what you see as the 11 separate cyclonumerals. They were once called the Road to Happiness.
Johnny had not known that. He saw these numbers, these symbols, every time he flew. He began to get interested. Soth was writing the numerals as pictographs, little pictures.
0 is an empty mouth. See the teeth? 1 is a claw, just 1 talon. 2 is a being and a pick. 3 is a being, a shovel, and a rock. 4 is a mine cart. See the 4 corners? 5 is what we call the off paw, the one with 5 claws. 6 is what we call the on paw, the one with 6 claws. 7 is an ore chute. 8 is a pot smelter. See the smokestack and the smoke? 9 is a pile of metal ingots made like a pyramid. 9 of them originally, but now just the pyramid. 10 is a lightning bolt, symbol of power, now just a slash. 11 is 2 paws clasped. That represents contentment. It's a little moral lesson, you see. If you dig and smelt ore, it lifts you from starvation to power and contentment.
He laughed.
Very few people know this. All they know is what time and haste boiled them down to.
and above his pictures he rapidly wrote the 11 cyclonumeral symbols as they commonly appeared. They still bore the traces of the pictographs. "I'm very glad to know that," said Johnny, and he was amused by it. The cyclos had been miners from the start. "I can do a little arithmetic in this system," he decided to really push it. "Where I get hung up is the cyclo force equations." And that was no lie. They gave him headaches. Nothing ever balanced. Soth was looking at him very keenly. "I think you are digging for the teleportation formulas." Johnny shrugged. "We have a rig running. We are making rigs." "Yes, I heard that," said Soth. "That's where all the new breathe gas and goo food came from. I heard there was a planet, Phobia, nobody could live on." He was plainly puzzled. "Ah," he exclaimed. "One of your scientists re-evolved it in some other mathematics, and you are trying to verify it against cyclo equations."
He laughed and laughed. Johnny gave him another bite of Kerbango.
"Ah, well, not that it will do you much good, but it's small wonder you can't work it out."
He laughed again.
"You'd have to be a native of Cyclo."
Footnote. For the Earth and several other editions of this book, translation liberties have been taken throughout, but especially with the explanation that follows, due mainly to the temporary unavailability of print fonts which include Cyclo numbers and letters. Translator. End of footnote. He laughed so hard he had to wipe his eyes.
"Oh, well," he said at last, "you already have teleportation, so what's the difference?"
He took another big piece of paper and drew a huge circle on it. Then he had second thoughts and sat back and looked at Johnny.
"If I give you this," said Soth, "what's it worth?"
"Money?" said Johnny.
"A separate dome, access to compound libraries, and tools to experiment with computers, and not to be cross-fired elsewhere."
"All right," said Johnny.
Soth made a fast list of what he had said.
Then he added, "Breathe gas and proper food for the rest of my life. I'm sorry to have to add this, but I've only 10 years or so to go, so it's only 10 years worth. I won't add anything else."
Johnny signed it. He even put a paw print on it, using his fingernails. Soth looked like he had lost 10 years of age. With a flourish, Soth pulled the circle to him. Then he put another piece of paper on top of it.
"Do you know anything about codes and ciphers? Cryptography? Well, anyway, here is the cyclo alphabet."
And he wrote it out.
"And here are the cyclo numerals."
And he wrote them under the letters and then started the numerals over again until there was one written under each letter.
"Do you see here that each letter has a number value?"
Johnny said he did. Soth laid aside the top sheet and again addressed the big circle.
"This," said Soth impressively, indicating the circle, "is the perimeter of the Imperial Palace of Cyclo."
He made a series of small slashes around the circle.
"These are the 11 gates. A lot of people, even on Cyclo, never knew they had names. But they do. Going counterclockwise, the names of these gates are Angel's Gate, Betrayer's Gate, Devil's Gate, God's Gate, Heaven's Gate, Infernal Gate, Monster's Gate, Nightmare Gate, Quarrel's Gate, Regal Gate, and Traitor's Gate. 11 gates, each with a name."
He took a book, Force Equations, off his shelf.
"It doesn't matter which types of equations in Cyclo Higher Math. They're all the same. You mentioned force equations, so we'll use those. No difference."
With a dig of his claw, he opened the book to the point where all the equations were summarized, and pointed to the top one.
"Now, you see this B? You might think it is a symbol for something in cyclomathematics,
but there is no B that represents anything mathematical except betrayers. He pulled the first paper back.
So, where that B occurs, we see that the letter B has a number value of 2. So we just have to add or subtract, or whatever it says to do to B, the number 2. When we get to the second stage of the equation, there is no letter, but a cyclomathematician knows you must take the second letter of betrayers, which is E, and then look up the number value of E, which is 5, and factor the second stage of the equation with 5. Now you get the same equation to its third stage, and a mathematician knows he has to factor it with the number value of T, which is 20, and so on. If the letter in the original equation were I, then we would use its number value and follow right on down with the number values of the letters for infernal. You always have one of these letters in the first equation, so you always have the gate name. And you have to use it. When they put the equations together, they constructed them backward from the answer so a gate name would fit. Got it?
Johnny got it. A code and cipher mathematics. No wonder nothing ever seemed to balance. This made even the original equations rigged. And add to that all the complexity of a base 11 math, and you had what would appear to any outsider to be an utter mess. He was glad he had the recorder running under his lapel. Completely aside from his being no native of Cyclo, the gate names themselves were weird.
I have to be honest with you, said Soth. I don't know where I'm getting all this impulse, to be honest, but all this will be of limited use to you.
6. Johnny sat very still. Something else? You mean he'd gotten all this way and he still wouldn't attain it? But he didn't speak. He waited. Soth fiddled a bit with his papers. He picked up the contract Johnny had signed and then laid it down again. Obviously, he was having qualms about the honesty of accepting it.
You have to understand how crazy they were on secrecy, he said at length. Although what I have given you applies to cyclomath in general, there is another circumstance. When equations are applied to the calculation of teleportation, you won't find all the answers in the texts.
Soth sighed.
The government was afraid of a lot of things. Among them was the possibility that intergalactic mining employees out in some far planet might get ideas or go into business for themselves. So the exact sequence in which you use the force equations is not revealed in the texts, and I think there are dummy equations there as well. I could not work you out a console.
Johnny objected. The Chamco brothers seem to be working on it.
Oh, the Chamco brothers, said Soth impatiently. They might have monkeyed about. They might even have tried, but they wouldn't know.
He swept a paw in the general direction of the other cyclo dormitories.
These clods here, he said with contempt, could none of them build a console. They would know what I have told you, and it would work for other things, but not consoles.
He looked at the contract longingly. Then he confronted Johnny.
There was a special class of trainee at mine school. The catrists went over each incoming class with the greatest of care, looking for the most brilliant new students. They were quite rare, really. And when found, they trained them lengthily in every branch of mining activity, theory, and practice. The Imperial government was determined that only one personnel on any planet would be able to build a teleportation console for use in times of emergency or to repair one. So they specially trained this group of students. We used to call them the Brain Brains. They weren't always the best people to know, but the Catrists thought they were. And as the government and company were so crazy on the subject of secrecy, of course the post to which these Brain Brains were appointed
was that of security officer. Turl, thought Johnny. And almost as if he was reading Johnny's thoughts, Soth said, Turl was a brain. This book is continued on Cassette 15, Side 1.